I'm Gail Hunt, and I'm excited to bring you Fun Time with Cliff Goodwin, a rock and talk series of Cliff's Tales from the Road, a behind-the-scenes look at his rock and roll adventures right here at WCUW.
So, you know, again, to bring around to the people who were listening to the last episode, our fearless leader, you know, you tried to do demos, and of course you knew what the goal was. But we're in Worcester, Massachusetts. You know, so it very quickly and very rapidly turned into, okay, now you're kind of like making a living. Of course, we know that you're not, because you're still living with your parents and you're still a teenager. But, you know, the real focus at the tip of your nose was the gig this weekend, not, you know, playing Madison Square Garden, you know. So from that point of view, we eventually did demos, but nothing came of it, of the American Standard Mark I. Hmm. No.
So there was an American Standard Mark II?
That's the one that eventually got signed. Yeah. But to get to that point, things had to disintegrate and start up again, which is what happens to bands, you know? It's as simple as that. I mean, American Standard, we thought, went as far as it could be, and there was an idea to merge the band with a band called Swallow out of Boston, a big horn band. A great idea, but suffice to say, the end point was no. It just didn't work, and so both bands kind of fizzled. Swallow, the last version of Swallow, kind of fizzled, which was a great band. The bass player was Vern Miller from Burying the Remains. A guitar player named Phil Green, who ran Normandy Studios down in Rhode Island for years. Just great. No place for me in that. But, you know, they both fizzled. And then I started a band called Spitfire for a little while, which was a hell of a lot of work and almost killed me. It was an essentially original music band, which was a lot of fun, but it was really difficult because you're starting from nothing at a time when people began to not really care. That lineup was a guy named Butch Eitri on drums, a guy named Bobby Horn on bass, a singer named Dave Primo, a keyboard player named Frank Savino, and me. It lasted very short period of time.
And how old were you at this point?
Let's say I am at that point, let's see, that must have been 72, so I would be maybe 17, 18.
You know,
yeah, and the action hadn't even begun yet.
I know.
You know, like, what is your impetus?
That's a good question, Dan. My main influences, we always focus on the Beatles, but I can honestly tell you, until the current band I'm in with called the Silverbacks, I never did a Beatles song. Of course, with Joe Carker, with a little help from my friends, notwithstanding. But I'm talking about in any of my local bands on the I'm coming up, never did a Beatles song. Don't ask me why. Don't understand it. So my inspirations were the British Invasion guys. You're talking Cream, Clapton, Jeff Beck, without a doubt. I named my son Jeff. We did, actually, name Sam. It was a joint adventure. You know.
Yeah.
And then Jimmy Page, you know, Zepp. So, you know, at that point, you're talking 19, when those first records came out were like 69. So I'm 16. Perfect. Fertile ground.
Yeah.
In a band, listening to these guys going, wow, this is really what I want. So you had, you know, Cream, Jeff Beck Group, Zepp, you know, 10 years after, eventually Free, Savoy Brown. I mean, I can tell you all the subgroups, the subsets, you know. Of course, I was a Yardbirds fan, without a doubt. We did a lot of Yardbirds stuff in the end. They introduced me, those guys in the end introduced me, you know, to a lot of the original versions. You know, for example, in my world, Tobacco Road was done by the Blues Magoos. Well, that was a hit in America. It was originally done by the Nashville Teens. Daddy Rolling Stone wasn't a cover by the Who. It was done by Earl Preston and the Realms. You know, so they hip me to this kind of stuff eventually. which was really, really valuable to understand the origins of that R&B kind of rock and soul thing that really is kind of my stock in trade, even to this day. So those were my inspirations, without a doubt. And of course, you could see these guys because they were coming through places like Boston Tea Party. And then the other side of that coin, around that time and a little bit, well, around that time, we can say for sure, keep in mind. Now, here's the advantage of being in Worcester, Massachusetts. How many colleges did we have? Any given autumn weekend, urchins like myself could wander up to Assumption and see Jefferson Airplane, Families, Cactus, the Youngblood. We could wander over to Clark University and see Hendrix. I missed that one, but, you know, Procol Harum, John Mayall, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, Chambers Brothers. It kept going. Holy Cross. I remember seeing Mountain at Holy Cross. I didn't see the Who up there, but I didn't have to go to Holy Cross. I didn't have to get all the way to College Hill and walk that far. I could just walk across the street to Alden Hall, you know, or Atwood Hall over at Clark, or up at, Worcester State, you know, whoever was, in any given autumn weekend. These bands, because keep in mind, there wasn't an arena circuit. I remember walking down even much, much earlier than that, walking down to see the Stones at the Worcester Auditorium. I had an empty clarinet case, and I walked down Institute Road, walked up to the side door, you know, the Worcester Auditorium. And back then, the ushers that were the ushers for those shows were kind of like guys that looked like the Muppet, the old men in the Muppet in the Muppet Show. You know, this guy comes to the door and he goes, "Musician?" And I was too young to really understand how to lie, but I held up the clarinet case. He said, "Come on in." Well, I didn't really ever get to hear the Stones that night because they spent an hour and a half or 2 hours chasing me around. They realized I wasn't a musician. I was just a kid with an empty clarinet case. But I'm sure the Stones were really good. But the point is, this is who was coming through Worcester. World class, you know. And then when you're in a junior, senior in high school, you can actually figure out a way to get to Boston to go to the Boston Tea Party. And the Boston Tea Party had everyone. But I remember seeing Cream at a place called the Psychedelic Supermarket, which was off of Commonwealth Ave. To show you how much there was an appetite for this kind of thing, the Psychedelic Supermarket was a parking garage during the day. It was, and I saw Cream at the Psychedelic Supermarket, just up the street from Kenmore Square, heading out of town on the left, of the strip mall, and you walk down this alley, and that's where the Psychedelic Cream was. I saw Cream, you know. But to see these bands, these guys, really your heroes at the Tea Party, was just another element in, I really want to do this. I really, really want to do this, you know.
Hey, thanks for tuning in to Fun Time with Cliff Goodwin. You're tuned to 91.3 on the FM dial, online at WCUW.org. This is The Drive, and each Thursday at 6 o'clock, we're going to hear little bits of this stuff, and we have more coming at you right now.
And then, of course, you know, you're working. You start to, you know, we flash to American Standard Mark II, which really we're old enough now, so we got to make money. And I'm not talking about get rich. I'm talking about subsistence money, you know, a couple hundred bucks a week, a guy. Mm-hmm. But, and that we were playing the nightclubs. We hooked up with this guy, this agent named Ricky Carr, who we just lost him. He just passed away. Ricky Carr really liked the American Standard Band. This, by the way, was American Standard Band Mark II, which was John Riley, Howie Hirsch, Derek Dyer, who we found in Bermuda when we went to play in Bermuda and brought him with us, me, and Kevin Falvey. That was American Standard Mark II. And that was the band that got eventually signed. But we're not anywhere near there yet. We're years away from that, or a couple of years for sure. And you could work 7 nights a week back then in the mid-70s, without a doubt, easy. And if you did beach gigs, you had to do matinees too. Wow. So a given week, say a given June or July beach gig, 4 sets on Monday, 5 on Tuesday, 4 on Wednesday afternoon, 5 Wednesday night, 4 on Thursday afternoon, 5 Thursday night, 5 on Friday afternoon, 5 on Friday night. 5 on Saturday afternoon, 5, and I'm talking about sets now, 40-minute sets, and 5 on Saturday night, Four on Sunday afternoon and four on Sunday night. And that was the week.
And then two interesting, like, guitarist influence, because like Hendrix, or like what always interests me is like music was one thing. Like even before Clapton, it was one thing. And after Clapton, it was another thing. And then before Hendrix, it was one thing. And then after Hendrix, like, well, as a guitar player, it was different. Just like when Eddie came, all of a sudden, everything was different.
Yeah, but not to us.
But what's no, what I mean? What was
I don't,
it like?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that. I mean, yeah. Hendrix, you know, when I remember buying the first Hendrix album and promptly blowing up the amp I owned trying to do that. We had this really good Vox. In the end, we had this great Vox gear. Everybody had a Vox. I had a Super Beetle. The bass player had a Super Beetle. The George Evans had a Royal Guardsman. You know, we had really, in the end, really cool Vox gear. Back then, it was beautiful. But it was, wasn't rugged. And I remember, I had two Super Beetles when I blew one up promptly, trying to get it to go, woo, 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 woo. Forget it. That didn't work. So, you know, to me, There was no really before Hendrix or after Hendrix. There was Hendrix. There was no before Clapton or after Clapton. There was Clapton. You know, Clapton was... We really didn't know the provenance at that point. I don't remember thinking myself knowing the provenance of the Yardbirds. In other words, Clapton first, then Beck, then Page. We just knew that that was the... Someone quit. Why would they quit? Well, now we have the benefit of reading all the biographies and finding out what the vision of that guitar player was, and you know, it wasn't like Clapton was a traditionalist. He could care less about hit records. So as soon as the Yardbirds did For Your Love and Heart Full of Soul and all that stuff, you know, Clapton was out the door. See, wow. didn't even tell him, just left. But Clapton came out of Mayall's, you know, I remember buying the first John Mayall record that I could buy, which was the Beano album, you know, with Steppin' Out and All Your Lovin' and Key to Love and songs like that. And thinking, you know, this is essentially the gospel here, relatively unattainable, but nice to shoot for.
Yeah, it's.
I don't know about you, but I'm really enjoying these great stories from Cliff Goodwin. Next week, we'll hear from him about 1976-ish, when the American Standard Band connects with Joe Cocker for their first tour. Thanks for listening. You're tuned to 91.3 on the FM dial, online at wcuw.org. I'd like to thank Cliff Goodwin for this fun time episode. We look forward to hearing more next week. Tune in to The Drive at 5 and for our Rock and Talk series around 6 p.m.